So, hello and welcome to this week's installment of Nucleus Investment Insights. And today we're going to be looking at the almighty Australian dollar, and we've entitled today's presentation, AUD, the Global Whipping Boy. I'm joined today by our Chief Strategist, David Llewellyn-Smith. Hello, David.
G'day, Tim.
And our Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. G'day, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
Fantastic. Let's roll into the agenda for today. So we're going to be looking at the five drivers valuation model, covering off on Australia and global growth, some interest rate differentials, investor sentiment and technicals, the relative strength of the US dollar, and then, of course, rounding out on the way these themes impact the way that we run investments every day here at the MB Fund and Nucleus Wealth. As always, for those listening in on the podcast, I will be adding in a chart pack, which is available in the notes, in the show notes. So let's roll into it. Today, we're kicking off with Australia and global growth. Who'd like to take the stand, gentlemen?
Oh, I'll kick us off.
Good on you, David.
Yeah, so... rather than show you sort of 3 million charts on Australian growth and global growth, I've boiled this down to two in terms of their impact on the Australian economy and dollar. excuse me. So this first one, trade weighted index versus terms of trade. So the terms of trade, imports divided by exports, or the other way around, is a measure, you know, basically of national income, more or less. And if you have a look on this one, the blue line there, you can see that we've been through a sort of triple peak in the terms of trade, and this is kind of representative of our huge price gains in commodities, which you know tends to flood the Australian economy with income.
Mm-hmm. And for anyone listening in, you know, the line sort of runs at sort of 60 to 80 for from, you know, the 1960s all the way up to 2000, basically, at which point it took off as commodities did. And then we're still, you know, still at elevated levels. We're still at sort of 110 on the index compared to sort of that long term, or at least the long term average pre the 2000s of 60 to 80.
Yeah, so you know, it's probably actually been underreported just how big the recent spike in the terms of trade has been. It's at the highs of 2008.
Hmm.
And if you took out the other two spikes in you know, pre-GFC and post-GFC, this would be the largest ever mining boom in the history of Australia. it's a lot of income, and it's flooded the federal coffers and what have you. And what typically happens when this transpires, as you can see from the chart, from the red line, is that the Australian dollar tracks rises and falls in the terms of trade very reliably.
Okay.
Which makes sense because, you know, you have a lot of money flowing into the currency and, you know, investment that tends to flow in with that and good growth, etc. But this time around, if you can see on the chart, there's been a huge and pretty unprecedented divergence as the Australian dollar has fallen while the terms of trade has gone through the roof with the iron ore boom after the Vale accident. Mm-hmm. Earlier this year. So why is that? To some extent, it's because markets, I think, are interpreting the spike in commodity prices as very temporary.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the nature of the drivers, you know, in particular, Vale being a very temporary problem. But the bigger issue, if you swing to the next chart, is that this captures, you know, kind of the second half of the Australian economy and growth story, which is interest rate differentials.
Mm.
this is, you know, while we've been through this crazy terms of trade boom, we've actually been forced to cut interest rates because we've obviously had our big domestic housing correction.
Mm.
Inflation has been chronically low. And so the RBA, after, you know, being behind the curve for quite a while, has had to capitulate and cut interest rates. And whilst they've been doing that, you know, the Federal Reserve in the US has been hiking.
Mm.
So that's created this large, what is called a spread between the two interest rates. And it's very negative at the moment, which means a lot of capital flows out of Australia looking for higher returns and into the US. And so the way you kind of encapsulate these two charts, the terms of trade and this second one, interest rate spreads, is it's kind of the houses and holes economy economies going in opposite directions. Holes have been booming.
Yep.
Houses have been busting. And the net result of that has actually been a falling Australian dollar. As Australian growth has really underperformed global growth, and in particular US growth. So, excuse me.
And I guess I'd also throw one more thing on top of that as well, is that while the houses side has been busting, it's far from a typical housing bust. Usually a housing bust becomes because you get all this credit generation, which we had, and then you get the central banks raising rates, and then eventually you get some sort of accidents, and all of a sudden maybe the unemployment starts to peak. Sorry, unemployment starts to rise, and then all of a sudden you get this sort of snowballing effect where banks stop lending, and then because they've stopped lending, more people go bust, and then because more people go bust, then more people get unemployed, and you sort of end up in this sort of downward cycle. And we've sort of shortcutted all that by having a Royal Commission where we cut back on all the lending before, and so the housing bust is not a typical housing bust, I suppose. So not only have we got the mismatch between those, we've got this mismatch in terms of a housing bust, and now we've got the government frantically trying to prop it up by trying to get the credit going again to get the housing back before we've even had our bust, we've certainly had a down 10% ish, but it's not compared to the heights that the housing reached. We haven't seen anywhere near as big of a bust as what you would have expected.
And do you think that the RBA sort of were caught short with what happened with the Royal Commission? So essentially, Royal Commission rolled on, big tightening of lending. They've turned around and said, "Well, we'll pull this lever to get the economy going again, guys. is it going to work, or is that something do you think they factored in?"
Well, no. They've been furiously pulling at that lever since the. And even before the Royal Commission results came out, I mean, they've been working hard behind the scenes to restore fraudulent lending. And, now they've got their rate cuts going, of course. But they're not succeeding very well. I mean, there were structural shifts coming out of the Royal Commission that meant credit availability is not what it once was and isn't going to be for quite some time yet. Lending standards are just much tighter.
And you've either got to look at the Royal Commission and say, no, we thought everything was fine beforehand. These guys have come in and stuffed everything up. We just need to get things back the way they were because we were doing a great job. Or you take the sort of independent financial people coming in and saying, well, no, you are having a housing boom that was driven by, lending to people who shouldn't be lent to and giving them people far too much money. You need to come back to a more sustainable basis. And I think the RBA sort of caught somewhere in between those two stories, probably closer to the story of, well, we're just trying to keep everything ticking along here and make sure things don't fall apart on our watch.
Yep.
So we'd prefer that the lending was sort of a bit more out of control and things didn't fall apart rather than actually sort of go through that structural adjustment that needs eventually to happen.
Its sister regulators copped an absolute thrashing, though, in the Royal Commission. So
in
it's kind of fighting them as well. APRA and ASIC.
ASIC, yeah.
Which governs shadow banking to some extent. Yeah. Both of them copped a real pounding and have been, making much firmer noises than the RBA post the Royal Commission. That said, they're also easing.
More on ASIC side, I'd say, than APRA side.
Okay, so if we take those two charts, we've got terms of trade versus interest rate spread, and the interest rate spread has basically been winning. So if we swing over to the next chart, and by winning, I mean forcing the dollar lower despite the high commodity prices. And this is a sort of snapshot of market sentiment, and you can see the winning here, if you like, where net positioning for the market is very negative on the Australian dollar. It still is. It has been for a good year.
What David's showing here is net buyers versus net longs versus net shorts in terms of the Aussie dollar. Is that right? And this is on the basis of traders.
Yep.
As opposed to
the big commercial traders.
The big commercial traders. Yeah. And so so it goes through periods where people are net long and net short. And so over the last 10 years. We haven't had a sustained period of traders being net short as much as what we've seen over the last year. There's sort of like a big chunk where people have been quite negative on the Australian dollar. One of the issues partly with this one is that it's not a guaranteed source of where the Aussie dollar is going to go, because what, and it's actually at certain points it's actually almost a contraindicator, or it is a contraindicator.
Mm.
Once everyone's short, and then you get a little bit of good news, all of a sudden the Aussie dollar has to rally because all these people, there's a whole bunch of people all on one side of the boat, all of a sudden wanting to be on the other side of the boat.
Mm, mm.
And so, so this is sort of like a good indicator to keep in mind, but I guess it's probably one of it's less reliable than, say, the interest rates and and some of the other measures we're going to talk about.
Absolutely, and I'm really showing it to illustrate how bearish the market's been on the Aussie, I guess, over this last 18 months or so.
Mm.
And it's not as bearish as it's been, but it's still quite heavily short.
Yes.
Okay. So that does put some limits on the immediate downside, as Damo says.
Yep.
Okay, so that's investor sentiment is bearish on top of, you know, our two fundamental drivers. And that brings us to our fourth driver of value for the Aussie, and technicals. And I'll run you through a whole bunch of technical charts here quickly. But this first one is a snapshot of the Australian dollar versus US dollar weekly. And it basically has what is called a descending triangle, which is a very bearish pattern.
Mm.
I drew this up Wednesday, I think, and the support line at the bottom of this broke last night.
Right.
Like,
yep.
Plunged straight through it on the resumption of the trade war. So this is now an active chart.
Mm.
And it indicates that the next low could be somewhere around the bottom we reached in the GFC. So that's somewhere down around 60 cents. And if you keep going to the next chart, this is the flip side of that, which is the US dollar index. And it came out, it's got this symmetrical triangle, which is a neutral pattern. And it broke up to the upside in the last couple of days as well, broke out as well. So the flip side of the Aussie dollar pair with the US is also, you know, bullish in its chart. So we'll flip over to the next one. This next one is the equivalent of the market positioning chart that we showed you before, indicating sentiment in terms of net shorts and net longs. This has been quite a difficult chart for the Australian dollar.
But for the US dollar this time.
Yes, for the US dollar this time. This has been quite a difficult chart for the Aussie for a while, because the market has been so long, the US dollar, which, you know, suggested that at some point it might start to fall, especially with the Fed beginning an easing cycle of some sort. And so that might put upward pressure on the Aussie. But in fact, that long got blasted out pretty quickly over the last 3 months or so, and the market is now net short.
And what's interesting, I mean, we sort of don't take – this isn't sort of like a we don't look at technicals and this trading as being our fundamental drivers for any of our long-term thoughts. It's more of a question about short-term timing and positioning in terms of where we can see things going in the shorter term. And when we have, these are the types of things we'll disregard if we have a strong fundamental reason and we can see why we think the rest of the market's wrong. But it's interesting in seeing how far things can move. And I guess from one of my observations looking at these two charts is it's quite interesting that the US market's gone from being quite long, so sort of, I don't know, 60-70% of the way towards the peak of their 10-year sort of long height, all the way to short without the US dollar actually falling very far at all.
Yeah.
And so then, you know, that sort of gives you some idea that there actually is a fair bit of support. And so if you're looking at the reasoning as to why the US dollar could keep rising, you know, that type of factor, you know, gives you some confidence that you're on the right path in terms of expecting a higher US dollar.
Yep.
If the US dollar, you know, was going to fall away, you would have thought when they flipped from being net long to net short, you would have actually seen quite a decent drop in the
big drop.
US
yeah.
dollar.
So it's indicating a lot of underlying support.
Yeah. and it's the inverse of the Aussie one, which sort of suggested limited downside just in terms of the market being so short. But on the flip side of the pair, There is actually a lot of scope for the US dollar to run, at least in terms of positioning, you know, relative. So they kind of cancel each other out, was the point I wanted to make.
And the longer term view on currencies for my part is that it's driven by economics. It isn't driven by traders. Traders are trying to jump around and get in there before the rest of the economy, you know, ticks over. But in the end, if the US economy is growing stronger than other economies around the world, then they will be importing more than they would have otherwise done and exporting possibly less as their currency rises, you know, depending upon how it's all sitting. But the net effect is that the economics are what's going to drive where the current over the sort of medium to longer term is what's going to drive whether currencies are rising or falling. It's not what traders do, and it's not what technicals do. But over the shorter periods, we can use that to sort of give us. It's almost a bit of a smoke signal or an indication. Hey, is something. Here's something that looks like it might be a problem. Maybe you better go and re-examine your thesis.
Yep.
Or here's something that actually supports your thesis and so, you know, can give you a little bit more confidence.
Yeah, I was just going to say, using this sort of information is more of an ancillary option when you're going, okay, well, you know, we've got fours and against are quite even, so let's have a look at some of this ancillary stuff and see what the direction is going forward.
Absolutely.
And the
technical side as well, you know, I think from my perspective, I'm very much a fundamentally driven, but, you know, I find the technical side, again, show some interesting factors in terms of what I should be looking at in more detail or less detail. But particularly in the foreign exchange markets, there are so many traders who trade off the technicals. You can't ignore that these are out there, and that, you know, things like these support levels and other lines. There are so many people looking at it on that basis that you do get some holding around those levels and then some.
Yeah,
fall away. So it's almost a bit of a, because everyone else is playing the game using those rules.
Yep.
Even if those rules aren't right over the longer term, it's just a short term thing. You do need to respect that there are so many other players using it that
affects the game.
It needs to affect affects the game, and you need to affect that into your calculations.
And I suppose just broadly as well, just quickly, that the traders can change sentiment on a dime. Economies can change sentiment over a decade. Would that be a fair point?
Well, we have the tweeter in chief can change. Tariffs and other factors pretty quickly.
Yeah,
usually, you're right, usually economies take a lot longer to change. But in terms of trade, I think in terms of trade changes, we're going to see, we have seen over the last year or two, and we're going to see over the next few years, significantly more changes than we've seen for the past 20 years.
Mm.
You know, the past 20 years was very much a slow and steady, you know, gradually rise and quite an orthodox, whereas... you know, Trump's calling card is being unorthodox and willing to throw previous norms out the window. And so, I don't think you can completely expect that to go on the way it has.
Okay, great point. Roll on to the next one.
There's just one last chart, which is goes again towards the relative strength of the US dollar or the US dollar index. And again, this is a market positioning chart, but this time for the euro. As you can see, its positioning in the market is relatively close to neutral at the moment, having been very short. And the euro is the biggest component in the DXY, that's the US dollar index. So it's very important in determining whether the US dollar index will rise or fall. And there's still scope for it to go either way, basically. So again, you've got this. There's nothing extreme in the market positioning is the point.
Mm.
And so the fundamentals, you know, really are in a position to drive Forex values.
Mm. Okay.
Okay, so the five drivers then, we've still got bullish commodity prices in terms of trade. We've still got very bearish...
When you say bullish commodity prices, so bullish iron ore prices, oil and gas, which is becoming one of our biggest exports and stepping up there to... Not that the Australian government gets any money from it, and for the large part, even Australian companies don't get very much from it. But that's, you wouldn't say it's bullish at the moment. You'd say it's,
you know. I'll get into the risks in a sec.
Yeah, but I guess from a commodity perspective, we're really talking about one commodity. I guess that's where I'm trying to drive. You have our two major ones, iron ores, or sorry, let's call our three major ones. So iron ore, coal, and gas.
Yeah.
So gas is neutral, possibly even a little bit negative.
Price. Well, it depends how you view it. Like oil's still I mean, it's hovering 54 to 56.
Yeah, so
it's roughly $10.
Yeah.
It's actually not bad for a lot of the contract LNG. I mean, the aggregate of this is captured in the terms of trade chart, basically.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they're very high relative to...
Sure, but I guess what we're looking at, if we're looking at oil and gas and saying, well, look, they're about average price. You know, if you're talking oil and gas,
all at
$80 or $90, you're saying now it's...
And coke and coal, gold and iron ore are all very high.
Yes.
Thermal coal is falling quite fast.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's where I'm coming to from this. It's not a... While you say... Whereas when we looked at the terms of trade for, pre the financial crisis, it was like everything's up.
It's not quite the same story, no.
No, whereas now it's more of a selective case that, as you said, coke and coal's up. Basically, steel is up.
Yeah.
Coke and coal and iron ore are up.
Yep.
Everything else is either neutral-ish or even on slightly on the negative side.
Which is part, I think, of why the interest rate spreads have been more dominant.
Yes.
You know, because you don't have the same sort of overwhelming narrative of Chinese growth and Australian proxy boom, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm.
But just in terms of wrapping what the influences are, I mean, they are still bullish.
Yep. So that was the first one. First one was commodity prices high.
Yep. Second one... interest rate differentials are bearish, obviously, very negative to the US. Our third one, investor positioning, is roughly neutral. Like, it could go any which way. Technical's definitely bearish for the Aussie dollar. And the relative strength of the US dollar is also quite bearish for the Aussie at the moment. So, at the moment, that gives you a snapshot of why the Aussie dollar has... basically just broken down to post-GFC lows because it's a relatively bearish picture. But if we flow forward into the next chart and we're going to look at the upside and downside risks to where it might go from here, obviously the outstanding kind of issue today is a deterioration in the trade war last night with Donald Trump imposing a whole bunch of new tariffs. We've been... more or less expecting the talks to fail. This is probably a worse failure than we were expecting. We thought they might be able to put together some kind of a public relations deal at least, but, you know, it appears Donald Trump's not interested in that. It's either a real deal or no deal. And a lot of the rhetoric that was around the new tariffs this morning was very hawkish. And it wasn't just Donald either. It was in his entire team was in the White House with the announcement. So it looks like, a pretty determined administration. And, you know, we've seen time and time again over the last couple of years, whenever the trade war accelerates, the Australian dollar really, you know, takes a pounding for obvious reasons. We've already seen considerable damage done to the Chinese industrial economy. Sort of global supply chains, etc., leaving China, and that's only going to accelerate as the trade war gets worse. So that's a clear downside.
On the trade war as well, I mean, from a political perspective, I don't think it's particularly harming Trump's case at this point. There's obviously a few people who are upset, but in terms of farmers who are directly, but I think by and large, it's relatively supportive in the US.
I think so. I mean... Oh, do you mean economically or
politically?
Politically, sorry.
Yeah.
Politically, yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
I never bought the idea that he needed a deal for his re-election. I actually think, you know, a trade war serves his ends much better. There's nothing like getting the nationalistic spirit going keep an incumbent in place. And,
you need an enemy.
You need
might as well be
China.
China. Because it's not Russia anymore.
Yeah, so no, I think that's right. And obviously the prospect of four more years of Trump trade wars is, pretty Australian dollar bearish, if not outright China bearish as well. We don't have to face that yet, thankfully. We've got a year before we have to go there. But before we even get there, of course, at the end of October, we've got Brexit. We've got a hard Brexit locked into the current negotiations.
Mm.
And it looks to us like it's going to get triggered. There could be a new European deal, but we don't see any real upside for it. And more to the point, there's a lot of upside for Bojo to go ahead with it, insofar as his party's being eaten by Nigel Farage's Brexit party, and he just needs to do it to put them out of business. So that seems to us more likely than not, even though there are various kind of speed humps along the way. And that represents a pretty decent kind of shock in Europe. Certainly will give the UK a nasty shock, probable recession, and Europe as well, with, again, a falling euro, which, you know, going back to those market positioning charts, would really boost the US dollar at exactly the wrong time. And that adds, you know, more downside risk for the Aussie dollar. You put all of those things together and, you know, I wouldn't say I've necessarily moved to a global recession base case for next year, but it's certainly growing quickly.
It's gone from a tail risk to a genuine
material risk. Remember, most people consider a global recession to be about 2% growth.
Mm.
At the moment, we're doing roughly 3%. So to get there is not that big a deal. But if we did get down there or below 2%, then earnings are going to really cop it worldwide. And you'd expect the stock market to get thrashed. And then that opens up the possibility of some kind of shakeout in corporate debt, especially in the US, where it's hyper-leveraged. And an awful lot of it, you know, to execute stock buybacks. And, of course, commodities bust. As China, you know, succumbs to both trade war and falling global growth, and its industrial economy, you know, kind of just rolls over. It would stimulate, of course, but you know, you're going to see the bust first.
And part of the reason for the Aussie dollar, the trader side and the investment side for the Aussie dollar is that in a global recession or a global economic downturn, Australia is looked upon as a turbocharged way to play world growth. Because if I invest in Australia, then and world growth goes strongly, then commodity prices go up and the Aussie dollar goes up at the same time. So we get a double whammy on the way up. But on the flip side, when we are into global recession, the Aussie dollar goes down and the stocks go down. And so then I get double the downside. So from an outsider looking in, there's double the downside, double the upside. And so that's why, you know, the more pressure on the Aussie dollar, keeping in mind that as an Australian investor going the other direction, it actually offsets. So you're holding. So, you know, it actually does help cushion the blow investing internationally.
And I'll add as well, even if China does stimulate soon on the trade war and global growth problems, I still think that iron ore is going to bust. There's no way it's going to hold up at current prices. Demand will still come off and the supply issues have more or less been resolved. You know, Vale is kicking in again. Its CFO, I think it was last night, said its capacity has rebounded to much higher than its projected volume forecasts for this year. There's a rumour that Samarco is on the verge of returning as well. The Pilbara is throwing out iron ore like you wouldn't believe. Like there's so much idle production up there, it's crazy, and it's starting to come out of every little hollow log and cranny around the world. India.
Just to confirm, you said that there was idled production. So previously idled production is coming back on. There's not much. There's not much idle production.
No. So, and China is ramping its own output as well. So iron ore is going to bust either way. If we get the global recession scenario, iron ore could easily go sub $50 in 2020. And so that brings us to our next downside risk, and that is domestic demand in Australia, which is at the moment really struggling. You know, like we've had the ScoMo miracle and the RBA turn on a dime, but domestic demand is in trouble. We're going to get retail sales today. We don't know what they are, but the trend is very poor. Household consumption trend is poor. Housing has, you know, managed to stop falling for a couple of months, but that's all. There's a big dwelling construction bust underway that's looking like it's going to get accelerate to the downside on a number of different fronts.
And I guess the key to that one is the noting that so much of the recent construction boom was in apartments, that there's such a long lead and lag time that regardless of what decisions people might have made straight after the election, we're not going to see any. If all of a sudden everyone rushed out and suddenly started building more apartments, which we don't think they have, but it take 18 months before you actually saw that come through in the employment numbers.
Yep.
What we're seeing now is the effects from over a year ago, the effects from what decisions were made then.
And it's still getting worse, not better, because we've got the quality control crisis.
Yep.
Yes.
So nobody wants to buy, and then you've started to see big developers go bust. A lot of those guys are funded through sort of over the counter loans, gouged from shadow banks.
Yep.
And they're going to see losses and widening spreads. That's going to send others bust.
It's the whole part of that. The banks are very good at why you have credit cycles is usually because banks get out there and lend, and there's no risks, and everyone's chasing the latest dollar, and then all of a sudden things start to fall over, and people are like, oh, that's right. Property companies can go bust, and when they do, it's quite damaging. So even the banks that haven't lent to those ones all of a sudden go, well, let's just wind back our property book and make sure it doesn't happen to us.
Yeah.
And so basically it's all, it's either lots of credit for everyone, or all of a sudden, everyone's drawing back at the same time.
So there does appear to be developing a second leg down in the dwelling construction bust for Australia.
Yep.
This is like 100,000, 150,000 jobs in this sector, which boomed over the last 5 to 10 years. And then you have,
And also, sorry to jump in again, but the construction jobs are not the same as mining jobs in terms of the level of integration with the rest of the economy. So you find that construction tends to have what they call a much greater multiplier effect.
Mm.
So one job in construction also needs, lawyers and real estate agents and cleaners and, all these... there's all these other factors that sort of go into it, whereas a brand new mining engineer sitting in the Pilbara somewhere doesn't have a lot of extra jobs that it creates.
In the same vein as manufacturing, sort of as we saw the pullback in manufacturing, and it just sort of drained out second and third sort of industries in the same way. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we've got these various converging risks and they're headed to a point where we have, at least in the monetary policy side, exhausted stimulus. I mean, we have two rate cuts left in the tank.
Conventional stimulus, yes.
Okay. Two rate cuts left in the tank, and that is if they're going to stop at 50 basis points, which seems to be their intention. But we're not going to see all of that passed on to mortgage holders either. And it's a hell of a burden of risk that's coming there to be dealt with by such little easing in your mortgage rates. So, then there is, obviously scope for fiscal policy, but, the government's been very, very slow off the mark on that, determined to deliver a surplus right at the wrong time. And that would take them quite a long time to turn around as well. And they'll be dealing with their own commodities bust, plus all the automatic stabilisers that'll be kicking in. And so their surplus will evaporate overnight. And you've got state government austerity already as the stamp duty bust transpires. So you have a lot of negative stuff hitting domestic demand in Australia, which leads to, more RBA cuts, more downside risk for the Australian dollar, and then unconventional policy, which, we've already started a little with forward guidance. The RBA has sort of declared interest rates will be low for a very long time, which they've never done before. But there'll be new steps that will come as they run out of options if these risks transpire and we end up with a global recession and shock.
And I think I'm right in saying as well that forward guidance in Australia isn't as beneficial as it is in say the US, because the number of people who have mortgages all based on variable rates or very short-term fixed rates in terms of sort of 3 to 5 years tends to be the typical range people will fix, whereas in the US...
In
Australia, whereas in the US and some other overseas countries, you get the 30-year mortgages or 20-year mortgages with fixed rates.
Yep.
And so forward guidance helps because it brings down those longer-term rates and lets people lock in. in the end for Australia, because so many people are all invested at the
variable
rate, yep. and or you know 1 or 2 years worth of fixed.
Which is more of a marketing ploy than, I think, a strategic sort of thing a lot of the time.
Yeah, it doesn't make a lot of difference to,
that's right.
to the Australian economy.
So, if we look at, you know, that's a very bearish outlook for the Aussie dollar. If we got all of those things would have come together, we'd be looking at the 50s sometime next year. But, of course, there are upside risks as well. So, we run through those. And, you know, to some extent, these are the flip side. Obviously, of the downside, but you know, a US-China detente, I think we can put a red line through that one. Soft Brexit, maybe I'd put a pencil line through that one. Chinese stimulus
and no Brexit. What are you going to do with Brexit? Just rub it out.
Well, I mean, yeah, I guess so. You never know these days; anything's possible. Yeah. Chinese stimulus and stumble through. Yes, the Chinese will do what they have to. More empty apartments. Etc. And maybe that's enough to stumble through. But I think, you know, if you took out the iron ore supply shock this year, you would have seen iron ore at $60 or $70 based on demand. You know, Chinese iron ore demand is falling despite steel hitting new highs as they build as much as they can, largely because they're producing more and more from scrap. Even if we get a decent Chinese stimulus and stumble through, you know, with empty apartments offsetting industrial economy risk, you're going to still see iron ore fall. So even though that's an upside in terms of demand and perhaps sentiment, in reality, it's not going to make a whole lot of difference to bulk commodity prices. Another one that's a bit out of the box is an Aussie current account surplus, which we probably are going to print over the next 3 to 6 months, for the first time since like 1970, 71, something like that, which some argue, you know, would make the Aussie dollar very attractive. You know, that said, you've got to ask why you're getting current account surplus. There's a difference between getting one because you're booming and your exports are driving your economy wild, and versus you've got collapsing domestic demand and you're not importing anything.
No one's got any money, but you've still got a few steel contracts hanging out there.
Yeah, so I don't think that that's an upside risk particularly, but I do think we are going to see it briefly before iron ore tanks and it'll disappear and we won't see another one. Well, we may not see another one next year. I mean, if we got the global recession scenario and Aussie housing did a double dip, then domestic demand may crater and you could actually see another current account surplus. But it'll be fighting a trade account that's going backwards on exports. So. Yeah.
And then come back in another 46 years.
Yeah, 40, probably. 48 years. Well, unless we can, you know, I mean, that takes you more to the structural story where, you know, we actually probably need a dollar at 40 cents, you know, for us to really kind of restructure away from houses and holes and towards a broader kind of tradable economy.
And you think that's what it's going to take? It's going to take a 40-cent dollar for us to start manufacturing?
No. What David's saying is, if you got to 40, that would make genuine structural changes in the Australian economy. I guess from my perspective, why I'm saying no is I'm saying, look, I think once you get into the 60s and certainly into the 50s, you're getting things shifting into Australia generally from whether it's services or manufacturing. But the global businesses are shifting. Are happy to shift things into Australia.
They are
at 40 cents. They're more than happy. They're falling over themselves to try and get in.
Those sort of levels are based on crisis scenario.
Yeah, and that's the whole point though, because it needs to be sustained before someone's going to invest for a decade. And, you know, if it has a fill-up into the 40s, you're not going to spend $100 million.
I don't know, but Damo's right. Like, if you get a crash to 40, 45, whatever it is, 47, and then, you know, there was value there at 58.
Exactly. And that's where people who were going to spend $100 million and going, well, look, around about 60 cents, Aussie, that's fine. Yeah, I'm happy to do that at that.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, it's back to 40-something.
Yeah, press the button.
Go now. There's not, like, we've already done our analysis at 60 cents and we know we're happy to do it.
Yep.
We don't need to rerun the analysis. We know it's way better at 40.
Fair point. So, okay.
Yeah. And so the big one here for the upside risk is a Fed slash and burn. That is, you know, the Federal Reserve in the US getting over its insurance cuts and moving to a genuine easing cycle.
Mm.
And that will happen if we get into this global recession scenario that blows back into US growth and inflation, of course. The question about with that one is when.
Mm.
And, you know, if you do end up in a global shock with these various risks converging and it hammering stock markets, corporate debt, commodities, then the initial Fed cuts are unlikely to be able to support the Aussie dollar because you'll get a risk trade into the US dollar, like basically a safe haven flow, which you get nearly at the whenever you get one of these big accidents in global markets.
Yeah. And part of that upside, though, as well, isn't saying is that when you get economic downturns and global economic downturns across a number of countries, you get what they call competitive devaluation. Everyone wants a lower currency because everyone wants to stimulate their own economies by getting some growth by importing some demand from elsewhere or getting some new businesses set up. And the Europe has tended to be behind the curve. So the Euro's, you know, European Central Bank has generally been, you know, very staid and stuck in their ways. And so I think of all of the central banks, you'd have to look at them and say, well, are they going to do something dramatic that all of a sudden means that the euro actually is the currency that really falls and takes it in? And you go, well, probably not. Japan's been stuck there for 20 years trying various things. They're probably not going to come up with something brand new. The US has certainly shown more thought leadership than any other central bank in terms of when they decide to flip and when they decide to say, no, we're here to support and we're going to try whatever it is that's unconventional. They've tended to be thought leaders. The Australian RBA, Reserve Bank of Australia, which manages the interest rates in Australia, has been more on the European side of things than the US, I guess.
Yeah.
Although, you know, we were quite innovative in some of the inflation targeting and things like that 20-something years ago, we're certainly not at the forefront of sort of the thought process and certainly in terms of published research, in terms of, you know, what can we do to get around this. It tends to be more of the same, well, we just lower interest rates a bit more and everything should be fine.
Yep.
You know, and everything will revert to trend.
And deny low inflation.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Like,
weirdly.
And so what David's saying there is that, you know, a global accident or some sort of big downturn in the US, which would flow, you know, to the rest of the world, where the US central bank turns around and decides, right, there's a genuine problem here. We're going to get out and fix it by whatever means necessary. Is that in that case, we'd expect that the Australian central bank would be sort of still just playing the same game they're playing at the moment and hoping that US demand will then lift the Australian economy and solve the problem for us.
Yeah. Mm. All right, very good.
Okay, so
pretty happy with the risks, and we'll shift over to...
We'll wrap it up.
Yeah.
So. Basically. So when we started doing these potties on the Aussie mid last year, we had a very different scenario. From memory, this was the tail end of the global synchronized growth phenomenon. And, you know, we had a reflating world with a falling US dollar, emerging markets and commodities all rising. And the Aussie dollar was up around 80 cents. And we thought China was going to slow. It was tightening. The terms of trade were going to fall. And we also could see the housing bust transpiring and the RBA was going to be forced to cut. And so those interest rate spreads we discussed were going to widen as the US, you know, boomed. And so that, you know, we got that relatively right. And, you know, it's more or less fallen away from somewhere around 80 cents to 68 and below today. And so, you know, when we look at today, we see more downside risk. Global growth definitely slowing. The trade war is going to make that worse. China's reflation is definitely struggling and will continue to do so. And that's triggering a European recession, which is about to get worse and may become very bad with Brexit. So base cases for all these things to get worse chronically, with the possibility, distinct possibility now of an acute shock. So for Australia, high terms of trade that have been supporters for the dollar will fall away. The RBA is going to outpace the Fed in easing in the short term. But, you know, as all of these global growth impacts come to bear on the US, then eventually the Fed will turn more bearish, more dovish than, perhaps not more dovish than the RBA, but certainly as dovish. Mm. And then, you know, we'll be into sort of global recession dynamics. And we'd still expect the Australian dollar to fall until such a point where you get, you know, the first sniff of recovery. And then, you know, globally, I mean. And then once you're into a new cycle, and the Fed has eased enough, you know, we're very likely to see a weak US dollar into the new cycle, which is, you know, when people would want to be owning gold.
Just on that note, just had a question drop in. If the RBA decides to implement deep negative rates, what effect will this have for cash deposit rates and cash securities more broadly? I guess in Europe, negative interest rates have stayed at an insto level and has not really followed through to retail deposit rates. So there's been a bit of margin there. So thoughts on that one? So, the future of the actual term deposit and retail cash returns with what the RBA's got in mind.
Yeah. Given current structures, it's very unlikely you'll see negative interest rates. There's been a number of thought pieces out there which are talking about maybe if we can get everyone onto digital currencies, then we can start giving people negative interest rates and forcing them to get out to spend money.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe they'll get there. I think there's much better unconventional, but that seems like where you'd get to if you decided that the only possible way forward is monetary policy and we cannot use any other tool and there's no possible way we can print money and do all these other things. We have to try and the only tool we're possibly allowed to use is monetary policy. Then you can see it. But I think you're a long, long way from that, and there are lots of other tools.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, and I wrote a long piece on this probably about a month or so ago. You know what? In a way, this is the the European Central Bank, you know, screaming at the Germans, please get out and spend some money. We will, you know, you have got negative. The government can borrow at negative interest rates. If you give me, you know, and it's at 20 odd years. So you can give the German government €100 today,
and you don't get it all back.
And they will give you back less than €100 over 20 years.
Yeah. It's even in the periphery now.
Yeah,
like there are junk bonds that are negative in Europe. Yields. So
they're basically saying, please get out and spend money.
Mm.
Now they're still, and you still have the German, finance minister was out a couple of weeks ago talking to the Italians about saying, you know, lecturing them about how they need to be, you know, we need some more austerity. You can't run bigger than 2% deficits because that has to be funded at negative interest rates. You're like, yeah. If you've got negative interest rates, you want as big deficits as you can. Yeah. Like, I'll lend as much money to anyone who wants to lend to me at negative interest rates. Anyone who wants to pay me to take their money, done. Yeah. And that's what the they're effectively printing money in a way because they're saying, we're going to reduce your borrowing costs below zero to try and get you to spend money. But it hasn't been successful.
Yeah.
So it's a question of saying, for me, it's at a certain stage, you need to just go, well, you know, maybe I should put the hammer away and stop trying to bang this screw into the wall using the hammer. Maybe I should actually just get a screwdriver out and use that.
Yep.
Yeah. Whereas it's sort of been decided, no, this is the one tool you have and that's all you can use.
Whack, whack, whack.
I mean, the RBA is more or less said it doesn't want to go below 50 basis points on the cash rate, which you know should mean deposit rates stay positive as well. You know, they want to give the banks some room for a spread, so I don't see negative rates coming.
Okay. And so
negative retail rates.
And
what we mean for their people is anyone who's sort of not into the whole interest rate thing is what we're talking about is what either institutionals or government bonds. You know, we're certainly not ruling out negative Australian government bond rates in Australia.
Yeah, right.
So
Interesting. All right. Very good. And thank you, James, for that terrific question. And thank you, gents, for another great show. We'll roll into next week. So we will be looking at, we will be speaking to a renowned property expert in Susan Farquhar, who has, Susan Farquhar, for those that have been following, we often get Catherine Cashmore in for her thoughts on the Melbourne, state of the Melbourne property cycle. And so Susan is of that ilk, but in Sydney. So it'll be very interesting to see and hear what has been happening up in Sydney and whether there is a resurgence or perhaps a double dip on the way. So we'll be speaking to her next week and bring that out to you at 12:30 on Thursday the 8th. And you can check that out at the Nucleus Wealth live webinar page. And of course, on our YouTube channel and wherever you get your good quality podcasts. On that note, well, that's it for now, and thanks for watching. If you like what you heard today and you'd like to hear more, head over to nucleuswealth.com/subscribe, give us your email address, and in return we'll send you a weekly email with new webinar topics, links for our podcasts, and other news from Nucleus Wealth. I certainly hope you've got something out of today, as I have, and we'll look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.